This week's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Heavy Play. If you're interested in getting some innovative curved sleeves, or even trying out their Equip Mag system that connects your playmat, deck box, and dice box together with high-quality magnets, check out HeavyPlay.com. Use the code DARKDEPTHS10 for 10% off your order. Again, thank you to our friends over at HeavyPlay.com. Enjoy the show. What's up, everybody? This is Gavin Verhey from Wizards of the Coast, and we are here on the Dark Depths podcast. Like, share, subscribe, all those great things. And today, joining us is a person I'm a huge fan of, a gigantic Eternal player, and just an all-around great guy. We're going to have a great chat today about all kinds of things impacting Legacy and Magic in general. Welcome to the show, Michael Mapson.
Hey, Gavin. Thanks for having me on my own show. How are you today?
You know, just making magic cards and casting spells over here in Renton. I'm actually in the office now, which is nice. We are we had a little break there while we were moving offices, but now back in the office making magic happen. So it feels good. All kinds of cool stuff coming out.
I'm jealous. That sounds like a cool day. I mean, I made pasta today, and that was fun, but pasta is not nearly as cool as magic cards.
You made pasta, and I made the pasta abilities. Between the two of us, we're good to go.
So, for the listeners, you may notice that Billy is obviously not here. That's because he's the worst, or also because he had a two-hour delay at his school today, and then because of that, he had to go to an after-school function. We're hoping he'll be able to join partway through the call, but if not, it'll just be me and our wonderful guest, or I guess I should say host, Gavin.
Yeah, Michael's like, I just don't know how to intro the show, and I'm like, well, I can intro the show. That's easy. No problem. So, yeah, I assume that's how you do it every time.
Yeah, so exactly like that. Okay, so Gavin, and you know, we've been waiting to get you on for a whole year plus like a month. But
holidays, am I right?
We do have some questions lined up for you, but first, I want to hear how was the office move?
It was good. Yeah, I mean, it's cool. We're in a brand new office, which is you know, it's fancy and it's got cool upgraded features. I don't know. You know, a lot of people think that we like work in a spaceship or in a wizard's tower or something, and I'm sorry to break the illusion, but it is still just an office building. But it's nice, you know. It's got lots of cool amenities. It's got snacks, and we're making some cool magic sets. I'm working on some very cool projects right now that I'm really excited about. I can't talk much about them, but they are they're pretty fun, and it's really wild to see like the entire landscape of magic ahead. I mean, we announced a ton of stuff to you all last year, but it's really wild to see the cards we're making in the landscape ahead and just see how much cool stuff there is on the horizon. I know that it sounds like whatever, Gavin, you wizard's shill, of course you would say that, but I personally do think it's really cool, and I'm working on a project right now that I'm really passionate about, so it's fun.
Out of curiosity, are there ever actually projects where you're like, yeah, this isn't great. Like, I don't love this. This isn't my favorite. Or is it just, like, always exciting?
Oh, no. There's plenty of projects I've been handed that I'm like, okay, I'll do this one. Not super stoked about it. I will not name those projects because I would never give the illusion I don't want anyone to hear and be like, wow, Gavin didn't want to work on that. But I will also, I'm pretty honest about that stuff, too. I'm not going to go out there. I love most of what magic, most of the magic stuff I get to work on. And so when I look like I'm relentlessly positive, it's usually because I am really passionate about it. There's been a couple projects I've worked on where you will find that I'm not as loud on the internet talking about them, and usually those are the ones I'm a little less stoked about. But a lot of those are in the past, right? The stuff I'm working on these days is all top-tier, high-level stuff that I'm really excited about, like my Commander decks from Murders at Karlov Manor are about to hit, which is a big deal. Doctor Who hit at the end of last year, which is a gigantic passion project of mine. I can say this actually now, which is cool. I'm the lead designer on the Final Fantasy set that's coming out in 2025. So that's something I'm really passionate about. I'm a huge fan of Final Fantasy. So, and you know, other stuff in the future too that I can't talk about yet. So the projects I'm handed now, I'm at the point where it's like, I get some pretty darn cool stuff. And my days of, I'll just say one, working on intro packs for sets are over. So that is, you know, something I did a decade ago that was, you know, they had to get made, but there are both no intro packs anymore, and I no longer make them. So
I kind of miss intro packs, which is a weird thing to say because I was not the audience for them, but I don't know. Something about having an introductory product for people I really liked, but I can also see how working on that is not nearly as exciting as something else.
Yeah, and to be extraordinarily clear, when I'm talking about intro pack design, I specifically mean the product that was called intro packs. These were like 60 card decks we released with a set, released a few of them. They were had no new cards. They had like a rare that was reprint from the main set. I think like the Planeswalker decks, in contrast, that we did later as an introductory experience, were way more fun to work on. You got to put a Planeswalker on the front of your deck. You got to make up a cool new card that got people excited. But like intro packs, no one, like very few people were stoked to buy intro packs. And I think that our learn to play efforts since then have just gotten a lot stronger. Right? We've got Planeswalker decks, which I think we did for a while. These days we have this 2-player starter kit you can buy that has, you know, either in the case of the Lord of the Rings, like some new cards, or in other cases, it's got some cool reprints, but it's got, you know, like an instruction book when you buy it that actually maps out your first few turns of the game. So you can sit down, just grab the little how to play and start playing, which is really cool. So our introductory efforts are like a lot better than they used to be. And, come a long way since me designing the Return to Ravnica intro packs, you know? But intro packs are actually, in general, not to just get on a totally tangent here, but I actually find them very interesting to design because when you're designing, like, a Magic set or, like, a Commander deck, for example, those are really interesting because you can do whatever you want. But with intro packs, or any kind of introductory experience, you have this very different perspective where it's like, okay, we have to make sure this is really good for the new player. Like, what are the things you have to think about? You have to think about Magic in a very different way. You're like, hey, this card has Vigilance, but it also has Flying, and we're going to need to write reminder text for all those things. Otherwise, the players won't know what it means. So there's just a lot of stuff you have to think about, or like mechanics that can trip you up. I remember I was watching. We do this really cool thing. This is like super tangent, but maybe the listeners will find this interesting. We do this super cool thing where every now and then we run these studies where we bring people in who have never played a card game before, and we watch through a two-way mirror as they try and play Magic against each other. And it's fascinating. The stuff you see people do is just like will blow your mind. But one of my big takeaways is, you know, there's a very common white kind of removal that destroys attacking and blocking creatures. There's this all over the place. But I remember watching this one day of introductory matches against each other, and one of the white decks had a lot of destroy attacking creature removal, and it made people feel so dumb. They like just learned what attacking is. Someone's like, oh hey, you can attack with your creature. Oh cool, I'm gonna attack. Okay, kill it. And I was like, and you just watch the people do this over and over, and it's like they feel like they got tricked for attacking as a new player, and the lesson they were supposed to learn was never attack. Bad lesson. So there's a lot of very tiny things like that you would not expect that come into play when you are designing introductory products. So I find them super interesting. I just picked on intro packs in particular because it was, you can only construct them with cards out of this set, you get no new cards. Often you're not even making a good new player experience because all you can use are like the white cards from a set. It's like the mono white intro pack from Theros. All you get to pick are like the white cards. So you're kind of just like picking from the scraps of the commons. And it's not a great experience. So, we really leveled up on intro packs. Anyway, I know that's what you came here for. All you wanted to hear about intro packs. So I'm glad I could deliver on that discussion.
I mean, you're joking, but I don't know. I actually do love the introductory products. I actually keep a set of 5 learn-to-play decks in my car at all times.
Like, yes. The half decks, right? Like the 30-card decks?
Yeah. Yes,
I have a huge box of those in my house. I've given them away to so many people. Whenever someone wants to learn, I'm like, awesome, let's break these out, I'll teach you. I have them from all kinds of different years. They're great. They are an amazing, amazing product.
Okay, so you mentioned Doctor Who. I don't want to go too far down that hole, but I do have to say, you talking about the set, like, on Twitter, like, you know, you're saying you could tell how you were passionate about that. Like, you tweeting about it, I haven't started it yet, but has made me, like, want to go back and rewatch the show. And I was very excited for that product. So just want to throw out there that was awesome.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was really a lot of passion in that one. Like, I'm a huge fan of the show, so it's really special. Really special to get to work on it. And I'm really fortunate I got to work on a bunch of, only a handful of Universe Beyond things, but the things that I've worked on are all things that I really care about. And that one is like, if I could pick one to work on, that would have been the one. And I'm so glad I got to.
I'm happy for you because, like, I don't know, it's just such a cool one. Doctor Who was cool. It was also neat because, like, all the secret layers before it weren't anything that, like, appealed to me personally. So that was the first one that was like, I watched this I watched the show. So like that was cool.
Yeah, for sure. Right, you have that like familiarity, which is awesome.
But so moving on from that, you know, we have a few questions that we were hoping to talk to you about. So the first one, just the obvious question, we talked about this some last year too. Pauper Format Panel, want to check in on how it's going? Do you know if there's been any talk down the halls about like maybe doing it for the other formats?
Yeah, so I think Pauper Format Panel is going great. I love it. It's really cool to work with the other folks on the panel. We're moving along. You know, we've had to ban some cards over the past year as different things have shown up. We even banned some cards recently, and it's just a really good group of folks. And I really love being able to monitor the format this way. So I mean, I could tell you about how great it is, but it's gonna be exactly what I told you last year. I think it's working great. I'm a big fan. In terms of other formats and any panels for there, there's nothing to talk about at this time. I know there's constantly a request for a legacy format panel and to a lesser extent a vintage format panel. The thing is, like, I wouldn't be the one running those because I know Pauper really well. And I think anyone that helps run a panel should know the format pretty well inside Wizards. I'm sure there are experts. In fact, I know there are experts in the building on those formats who would be good fits for it. But I don't know of any initiatives there. But if there is, we'll announce them and you'll hear all about them, I'm sure. But yeah, that's something that I get asked a lot. And my basic vibe is I'm just going to try and keep enjoying the Pauper Format Panel and doing a good job with that. And someday, if a Legacy Format Panel happens, but that I think that'd be potentially pretty cool.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's always nice because I feel like Wizards is unfairly criticized for a lot of decisions. And I think like the Pauper Format Panel is one that I've like basically seen universal praise for. And I'm sure there's people who probably don't feel that way. And I'm sure you've heard
there are.
But like, most people I've seen have been like, oh, these are like great takes. Like the explanations are like really well thought out. And so, you know, you guys do a great job on that.
Yeah. In general, like, you know, I was a little facetious there with what I said. But in general, what I find is, I mean, you know, you always get a few haters here and there or whatever. But in general, the thing that is the most telling to me is even when people don't necessarily agree with the decisions, they're always like, hey, I love the transparency. And I think, and I love the write-ups and the depth that you go into. And to me, that is really meaningful, right? Because not everyone's going to agree with every decision you make. Some people are going to be like, I wish that card wasn't banned or like the format before or whatever, right? But I think if people can be like, hey, I disagree, but appreciate the rationale and the work you put in, that's still a big win for me. So I'm really glad people seem to take that perspective. And, you know, it definitely keeps the pressure on, though, because every time we ban a card, I'm like, okay, time for another six-hour session writing this article and gathering all the data. But, like, I want to do it right. It's really important to me to do it correct and to communicate all that stuff. So I'm a busy person, but when it comes to interfacing with the community, making sure that I put my best foot forward in regard to what we do to our formats is paramount. So for sure. And I'm glad people seem to enjoy it.
Yeah. So speaking of things that people seem to enjoy, how do you feel about how Magic Cons are going?
I feel pretty good about the Magic Con program. I mean, I've been at all of them so far. I love them. They're really fun events. I think it's really been a process of evolution, right? When you look at Magic 30 at the end of 2022, that event was really cool in a lot of ways. Like, we executed on a lot of the new stuff so well. The live shows were incredible, and the space looked amazing, and all, merch was great, all this stuff. Conversely, there's like some very basic things, like just at a place to play Magic at, for example, that people had a lot of trouble with, right? So there's a lot of learnings from that show. And it's been really fun, actually, looking at the past year, 2023, and the four Magic Cons we had, and seeing how every show we iterated on what we learned from the previous show, right? So we adjusted for Philly, what we learned from Magic 30. We took those learnings and adjusted for Minneapolis, and so on and so forth. And I feel like by the time we got back to Vegas at the end of last year, it was like this big hero's journey, right? Because Magic 30 was a really cool event that also had some big problems. And by the time we got to Magic Con Vegas, it was like, what a huge celebration. And it went off amazingly. The event was a blast. There were very few complaints. And I was really proud and happy with it. So I love them. I'm a huge fan. I'll be at Chicago in a few weeks. And I love the live stuff I get to do, like working on Game Nights Live. That's a real blast. and the unknown events have been a real blast to get to create. That's something that really took off. I did not know how those were going to be received, and the unknown events have become like a highlight for so many people at these events. Now, if you're listening to this and you're like, an unknown event, can you explain what the unknown is? If you're not familiar, what they are is basically they're sealed deck events that people sign up for. They enter, but they don't know what it's going to be in advance. And then they're given some mix of product that is they don't know about. There's some rule set that is a secret that I've designed that they don't know about. And then the kind of gigantic cherry on top is there's a bunch of playtest cards that I've designed just for that weekend that people get handed to play with, right? And so you can kind of only get them at Magic Cons, and they are special and cool and wacky and weird, kind of like Mr. Booster playtest cards. And people have had a lot of fun with those. So that's been a very cool event series I've got to run. And we've got one coming up in Chicago in a few weeks.
I have not had the opportunity to play in one of those yet. I was at the first Magic 30 in Vegas. I was at Philly, which I definitely saw improvements between the two events. But I will be at Chicago, and I've been agonizing. So I'm just like, part of me is like, play the standard 75K. Like, your goal is to get on the Pro Tour, do that. And then part of me is like, you always go with the spiky path. Just like, go be a casual. Like, I want to try the unknown events because I've heard such good things after each MagicCon.
Well, we got one on Saturday and one on Sunday. So, you know, you've got lots of room to play with there. I would suggest playing the standard 75K. It's going to be an awesome time. It's going to be a huge celebration of standard. The event is going to be really cool. Like, I love high-level competitive Magic so much. In fact, when I was in Vegas, I was so bummed I couldn't play. Wizards staff aren't allowed to play in events like those for totally reasonable reasons. But as a former competitive player, like, when I see an event like that, I'm just like, oh, I want to go play so bad, you know? I want to go play so bad. And so the standard open sounds awesome to me. I would definitely go play in that. And the way I think about it is, look, you know, playing the standard event, either you're winning and you're doing great, in which case, awesome, you're winning and you're doing great, or you bomb out on, then you've got time to go play in an event and do whatever, right? So you can definitely go do all the casual things if you bomb out of the main thing. You can't like re-enter and go back and do the main thing. So my tip would be go do the 75K, have a blast, and then, you know, if it unfortunately doesn't go well, we got the whole con to hang out in. So that's my tip.
Man, I was leaning towards doing the casual thing, and now you're, like, making good arguments.
I mean, ultimately, do whatever you're going to be happiest with, of course. I just, dude, large-scale competitive events are just the best. I love competitive Magic so much, and it's going to be one of the first big standard tournaments IRL in a long time of this degree, and so I think it'd be kind of cool to be there and see it unfold. Also, I think Standard's looking pretty good right now. I know this is a legacy show, but I don't know if you've had the chance to play much Standard, but it's been really cool seeing, like, I know there's this meme about Standard is dead, et cetera, but over the past month or so, it's like the RCQs have started back up, and there's been this huge spike in Standard play, and stores are getting 40, 50 people to play in these qualifiers. I think we're seeing a big resurgence of Standard right now, and I think, like, this event is going to do some really cool things for that, and the help support is pretty good. I've been having a lot of fun with it, so, you know, come check it out, and yeah, play, you know? Win your share of 75K. Yeah. What's not to love?
That's true. Yeah, so I have been playing the format. Been playing it on Arena, having fun. And I have not played an RCQ yet, but I judged an RCQ on Saturday. We had like 60 players.
Wow,
I've seen awesome. 70 players. Yeah, I do think the format is good, like you said. I think for me personally, I will probably lean casual because the week before it, So the week before I'm not playing Magic, but the week before is like the RZ, the week before is like SCG Hartford, and then like the week after is SCG Philly, so like tons of time.
You got lots of competitive Magic around then, yeah, that's fair.
So, you know, you can never get enough. I was wondering, like, how has that experience been? Like, I know you've been at Wizards for what seems like forever now, but not getting to play in those high-stakes events, like, does that drain, like, how often do you just feel like you're missing out?
I mean, it's just the trade-off I know, right? I've known it for since I started 13 years ago. I love competitive Magic. I love playing professional Magic. Someday, if I retire, you know, whatever, I hope to be able to go and play in big tournaments again, you know, because I love it so much. But it's just a trade-off I know I'm making, right? Like, it's like I can't go play competitive Magic, which sucks, but the upside is I get, you know, a full career and I get to do all the other stuff that I get to do. So it ain't so bad, right? But whenever I go to a big tournament and I see people playing at a competitive level, I just always have a tiny bit of my heart that I look and I'm like, I want to be doing that right now, you know? I found my ways to scratch that itch in other ways. There are some medium-sized competitive events I'm allowed to play in. There are just, like, you know, even a cube draft with friends where you have, like, a lot of pride on the line. Like, you feel your heart pump a little bit. And I actually took a trip last year out to Italy for Poppergen. Poppergen is, like, this huge Italian popper tournament series that they run with, it was like 600 players or something. It's bananas. And I couldn't play in the main event, but I played in a bunch of, they had some very big side events with like hundreds of people. And I played in some of those and I was like, all right, we're playing eight rounds and, you gotta go X1-1 to make top eight. And that was cool. And I made top eight, which was great. So sometimes you got it. Sometimes it's like, am I all washed up in Magic? And the answer mostly is yes. But it is nice to know sometimes about a little bit of it, right?
I'm sure you're not washed up. I actually often wonder, like, if, like, all of play design and, like, all the developers and everyone just, like, came out and, like, had a battle against, like, a team tournament against, you know, some high-level pros or high-level grinders. I wonder how close it would be. I feel like the designers have it still.
Yeah, I would say one thing I find about working at Wizards is that your technical play gets worse because we're not focused on technical play when we're playing here. So like the very tiny minute stuff we just degrade at. And the, we're focused on like what makes the cards fun. And we start thinking about things that aren't about just trying to make the best play or, you know, or mind games or whatever on every single turn. So our technical play atrophies, but where we excel is at like the big picture play, like deck selection, deck building, that kind of stuff. Picking up formats, like we're phenomenal at picking up formats that are new because we know really well how to like jump into a format map that no one's ever played. So like we're going to know like what categories of cards are strong. So I think we put our skill sets in like a very different place, and depending on the tournament, that could be very good, very bad. Right? If we're playing standard that's been out for 2 months, we're going to have no shot. If we're playing a brand new draft format, well, then that's where we're going to excel. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm happy to 3-on-3 Wizards employees versus current professional players and see what happens. I'm game. Anyone out there wants to take me up on the challenge? Let's do it.
Next question. It's actually perfect because you just talked about draft. You guys have been like killing it on draft formats lately. I just feel like every set that comes out, I just hear people talking about how great the format is. I feel like numbers keep going up. I'm not going to call out names. I think there's been like one or two misses, but like overall.
Yeah, I'm sorry about Street Street Capenna. Sorry.
You know, I actually liked that format, and everybody was like, this format's trash. And I was like, am I broken? Like, I don't.
Street Street Capenna to me, not to just totally derail this, but it illustrates how a couple very small things, like a couple commons, can really alter the format. And I think there's a couple commons made things like a little too fast, didn't allow for the three-color stuff to show up as much. And there's other challenges that format had too, but I think that it's a few commons can really go a long way toward changing the speed of a format. Anyway, I derailed you. Not that I'm like totally slamming the format. I thought the format was totally fine. I think if it were 10 years ago, it would be like, just a new Capenna was sick. But just by, it's exactly what you're talking about, by the standard of all the sets have been like really good limited formats recently, when there's one that's like a little weaker than the others, it really stands out, you know?
I mean, like, has there been some change in the way that you guys are designing cards that has led to that? Or, like, can you speak to, like, where that success is coming from?
I think a few things have happened. I mean, one thing is just iteration, right? We've been doing this for a long time. We have a lot of knowledge in-house of how to make limited formats. And the second is we have our play design team kind of at full power, at least the fullest power it's been. And they spend a lot of time drafting and iterating and trying to get the archetypes right and deciding what's fun, what's not going to work. And this one team really focused on doing it. So we just have so much experience in iteration on it. And I think a lot of it ultimately does come down to that. There are other things like picking themes that are going to work well in limited. The addition starting about a decade ago in Theros, original Theros, of the two-color pairs has just made draft a lot more accessible. But, we still, of course, leave a lot of fun on commons and weird build-arounds who can go in wacky directions. We do things, we put things in to make sure that they're replayable. There's a lot there, but also this comes down to iteration and practice. And, a lot of Magic sets, like, what makes a Magic set fun for limited is 3-mana 2/2 flyers with a small ability, you know? Like, we kind of have things figured out by this point. And I'm not going to say we're not going to have misses and we're going to try themes that aren't going to work or whatever, but it takes a lot of time. We spend so much time on limited iteration. It's ridiculous how much time we put into limited. So, I mean, I think it's just that. It's just, you know, we put in the time to try and make it good, and we know about tiny tweaks and heuristics that make a big difference. So anyway, long-winded, but I think TLDR is just, we've done it a lot of times.
I mean, that makes sense. But yeah, it's been awesome, and people just having so much access to it on Arena, the fact that, like, people aren't getting burnt out on these draft formats is, I just think, really impressive. Definitely a testament to what you guys are doing.
Yeah, and it's a big challenge, too, right? Because the thing we're fighting against is people can draft more than ever before whenever they want and as often as they want. A lot of older formats didn't have to hold up to a lot of drafts because, like, how many times are you going to, you know, maybe the very top players will draft it a bunch of times, but how many times are you going to, like, draft, like, I don't know, Onslaught Block, the average player, right? They'll draft maybe every week at their game store back then. You do that a bunch of times, cool, that's great. But it's not like, hey, you're doing 50 drafts, and now people are just, like, jamming drafts in all their free time on Arena. And, you know, there's also tools like 17 lands that are giving you the perfect amount of perfect data, or not, actually, I would argue it's not perfect, but whatever. They're giving you pretty good data that we have to fight against. So it's a pretty big testament to the play design team's work and the design team's work that the draft formats are this good when there's so many being played and so many great tools that could theoretically homogenize them. You know, and like, when it goes wrong, it can go really wrong. Like with All Will Be One, learning that three colors were just heads and shoulders above everything else you could possibly do. Well, that's a problem. But for the most part, it's been pretty good.
Next question. We're talking about formats being good. What about when formats are bad? How do you as a designer feel when like formats require bans?
Oh, like constructed formats? Yeah. You know, here's the thing about bans. Obviously, we don't like doing them. We don't want to do them. We're not like designing two ban cards. Very strong opinion on this. But also, if we're not banning things every now and then, we're not pushing enough and trying enough, right? Because if we make everything really safe, you end up with like original Ixalan Block, which is a totally fine Magic set. It's got some cards, it's got some creature types, got some flip cards. It's neat, but it was kind of a medium set. It didn't really excite a lot of people because there just wasn't anything that was like, oh, wow, this is new and wild and wacky, and like I really want to check this out. It's got this really incredibly powerful card in it. You got to be pushing. You got to be pushing the boundaries a little bit. And it's a careful balance to make sure you're not power creeping while you're doing that. But, yeah, every now and then cards are going to have to get banned. And also the thing about bans are that, go back to what I was saying earlier about limited, the tools for information gathering are better than ever. There's a lot, if we replayed all of Magic's history, but with the tools that we have right now, like Arena Active and everything, just imagine that you're like, Magic Active started today and Arena existed today, and we played every season of Magic from the beginning till now, there would have been so many more bans in the first half of Magic's history because Zulus didn't play as much Magic. You couldn't play on Arena all the time. You couldn't crunch the numbers on the formats. The data was worse, right? I think that often people get really nostalgic around an era where bans didn't happen for a long time, which, I mean, I agree. I love that. But I think a lot of that was just because less was being played and there was less good data on it. And social media was, you know, less, put less pressure on things to some degree. Where now, you know, if something gets busted, you learn very quickly, right? On Arena, if something is winning all the games, you will know in under a week if it is going badly. And that's not the kind of heuristics we ever had access to before.
I'm trying to think of what the last bans were. Also, how do you feel about the new, like, with the new ban cycle of once a year, does that seem like that's going well, or like how do you feel about it?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a lot of insight into because I'm not on the play design team. They've talked a lot about it and their various release valves and heuristics and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't have a lot to say there because that's not really my area of expertise. So as much as I'd love to be able to comment on that, I don't really have a lot when it comes to ban philosophy to that degree. Like the more like top level vibes, great about talking about that, but the specifics of band cadence, I don't want to speak on their behalf because they're experts at it, and I'll probably just say something dumb and wrong. So,
okay, that makes sense. Okay, so I have some questions from Twitter to ask as well. Those were all questions from like me and Billy. So, first question comes from friend of the show, Dr. Judge, aka Charles Feather.
Hi, Dr. Judge. Oh, Charles. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You probably know him from the Magicons, right?
Good dude.
Great guy. So he loves goblins. And I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, but he has been asking, begging, pleading for as long as I've known him. When will Goblin King receive the much-needed errata to make him a noble?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it's a great question. This is a top-level issue. I'm going to take it directly to the top, and I'll let you know. I mean, he's a king. You could argue that Goblin Kings are still not very noble, but it does feel within reason that he could have the noble type. So let me talk to some people and see what I can do.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it feels like a slight.
Yeah, I mean, that's really what's holding Goblin King back, I think. So,
okay. Also from Charles, the enchantment, the new enchantment type case, coming out in the new set. It's an interesting design. Do you think that's going to be like a one-off for the theme of the plane, or like how do you feel about those? How did those come about?
Yeah.
Do you think
the cases are super fun? I know you all haven't had the chance to play with them yet, but they're a great time. They give you like a little quest you get to go on, a little mini game, you know, and that kind of stuff is always very enjoyable. So they play really great, and it was kind of just a top-down thing from the design team for Murders at Karlov Manor. The theming is really themed to Murder Mystery World, right? They're called cases, so it's a little harder to do them en masse in a lot of sets. I don't really think it's going to be like sagas, right? I think it's going to be a lot more like classes, where we saw classes show up because they're really good for the theme of the world. We don't see classes all the time. Cases showed up because they're a really good theme for the world. I don't think we'll see them all the time. They're not going to be like sagas where they show up over and over again. I could definitely see another set using them at some point. I can also see a lot of opportunities for one-off cases in the future. Like, a lot of worlds do have a mystery or two, you know, that we can make cases for. But at the end of the day, it depends how players receive them, right? If you had asked me with Dominaria how quickly we were going to use sagas again, I would not have anticipated when we were working on Dominaria that we would now have sagas show up as often as we do. And so a lot of that was just player feedback. They really liked sagas. So if cases go over super well, then, hey, I guess we should do cases maybe more often. So, like always, it's put it out, see what the player reception is, and then kind of go back from there.
Okay. I'm excited to get to experience them. I'm always excited when a new card type comes out, and I'm curious if it'll have, like, any impact in Legacy, especially, like, there's the blue one that can be a Storm Engine. You know, obviously the whole set's not out yet. I haven't seen, at least I don't think it is. I don't know if I missed something today.
No, not quite yet.
But I, you know, I'm excited to see like if any of that shows up in Modern or Legacy.
There's at least a few Eternal shots in Murders at Karlov Manor, so stay tuned.
Okay. I think the land cycle is going to
see. Yeah, I mean, those are big ones. I mean, those surveil lands are incredible, right? The land types are what really put it over the top. Just surveilling, sure, whatever, but the land types, the fact you can just play, like, you can fetch land for a bit of card manipulation, like, that seems quite reasonable, especially in any decks that use a graveyard, right? If you're delving or what have you, being able to fetch and get two cards in your graveyard can be extremely meaningful, so I would not be surprised to see those show up in Eternal formats.
I feel silly, because I hadn't actually thought of it with delves.
There you go. This is what I'm talking about. So when you see cards early, we're really good at evaluating them quickly, but then 3 months from now, you'll be delving and crushing me. I'll be like, yeah, well, I knew delve was good 3 months ago, but that's not very helpful. So.
Okay. Next question. Do you have any recommendations or ideas? Sorry, I should say it's from. So this is from our friends over at the Buffalo Chicken.
Oh, hey, guys. I have a shirt with your name on it.
What suggestions, recommendations, or ideas do you have for continuing to grow the Legacy community? A follow-up to this, in what ways would WotC be able to provide support for smaller regional TOs or even at the LGS level specifically for Legacy? I'm not sure if you can talk to this second part so much, but definitely, you know, what do you have for ideas to grow in communities?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll talk to both aspects a little bit. So I don't work on this side of things as much, but we do have people who are in charge of like tournament circuits and working with our partner TOs. That, you know, and that they talk with people like Laughing Dragon and Star City Games and whoever to help run larger scale events. So if you are interested in running a large scale Legacy event and you're a tournament organizer, there are people to talk to that you can chat with, see if there's any way we could help support that. So I don't know the details, I can't make any guarantees, certainly. But it's a thing that could exist. In terms of growing legacy, I mean, I feel like the trick is getting people to play the format, because it is a fun format. It's very enjoyable. It's got a huge depth. It's got a lot of depth to it, a huge breadth of gameplay. The trick is just a lot of people think it's inaccessible, impossible to get into and play, and don't have access to it. So, I mean, obviously, this is going to depend on who you are and what cards you have. But if it's possible to build up multiple decks and feel comfortable lending those decks out to people, that can do a lot to the growing community. Like, I'll take Popper as an example. And obviously, Popper, very much on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to how comfortable you might feel handing someone a Popper deck. But the number of stores I've heard that are like, hey, we just built up some Popper decks, and then when people want to play the format for events, they don't have a deck, we can hand one to them. And then over time, they got into it, and their community grew and grew and grew that way. I've heard that story so many times. And with Legacy, I think if you have access to be able to play the format, that's the biggest thing. You know, so if you're able to build up additional decks to lend out to people that you at least, you know, if it's just friends that you trust, that's definitely something to consider. Other than that, you know, a Magic Online is a really great place to be playing Eternal formats because the cards are really accessible there. And they were doing a lot of cool stuff with it, too. So there's a few ideas. But ultimately, I think the best thing you can do is get people excited about playing the format, whether it's in-person, online, however you can. Because once people realize it's so cool, there's no going back.
I will definitely say, around here, there are a lot of people who are willing to loan decks out. I know sometimes people are hesitant to borrow the cards because people are just like, oh, this is like a lot and I don't know you that well, which I get, but I definitely echo the sentiment of loaning decks out will quickly get people in. I also think just like if Legacy players are more willing to play other formats, that also helps. Like, I think it's very easy for me to show up to like a Modern or Pioneer event and then, you know, not be obnoxious about it, but talk about like how fun Legacy is too and get those players to come. When people don't commingle and try out other things, then I think you can just seem like the crotchety old man being like, back in my day when we had
come over to Legacy Island and you can play it too, right? I feel like a well-rounded Magic player should try a lot of formats. It's cool to have a favorite. It's awesome if Legacy is your favorite or whatever, but it's worth going out and trying other things. A, so you just know what's going on, what people are doing, and B, so you can meet people who are in fresh to bring into your scene, right? And be like, hey, Legacy's awesome. I'm playing it this Friday at the store. Come on down. I'll lend you a deck. You know, you're my buddy now. That kind of stuff is really powerful.
So the next question is from friend of the show, Ethan Wallace. Are you happy with where the initiative cards and decks have ended up post White Plume Adventurer ban as a sort of follow-up to your feeling about the mechanic last
year? Okay, well, I'll start. I don't remember exactly the words I said last year. I've got a pretty good idea of what I said last year, though. I'll start with just a recap for anyone who didn't listen to last year's episode. Very unhappy with how initiative landed. I would say having to ban initiative cards in Legacy, not on the roadmap for Baldur's Gate. I mentioned earlier, you got to push. And the thing is, we're always trying new things out. We're going to be pushing, right? You're going to have to ban cards as a result of that. It is a bummer where you have to spend your points banning cards are like, this mechanic designed for Commander accidentally missed and ended up... It's like... You got on the wrong flight. You know, you were supposed to fly to Commander Town. Instead, you boarded your flight to Legacyville, and Commander didn't end up using the mechanic very much, and Legacy ended up breaking it. You're like, well, that was... that didn't really go as planned. You know, we learned a lot of lessons from Initiative, like a lot. And ultimately, I think for the Commander format, it had some really noble goals, and it plays really well when it shows up. It's a great limited mechanic, but it's the overhead of knowing what it does. And a lot of people is not wanting to opt into that in a very opt-in format. Left it out of Commander decks. And because we balanced it for Commander, and we especially had the 5 damage mode on there, it just made 20 life 60 card formats the best place to use it in, which is a real bummer. So anyway, just to get around to it, not happy with how it landed at all. Bummer we had to ban a card Legacy because it was too strong. And hopefully we can avoid that mistake in the future. Definitely we're putting Commander cards... through and mechanics through like a lens of, hey, let's not mess up Eternal formats with this. Like, usually in Commander, on individual cards, there's a lot of knobs to turn to keep them out of Legacy, because Commander is a format not very sensitive to the rate of a Magic card, and Legacy is a format extremely sensitive to the rate of a Magic card, right? So in Commander, if you change a card from costing 3 to costing 4 and give it +1/+1 and a keyword, that might just be sicker for Commander. But in Legacy, the difference between 3 and 4 mana is the difference between a card being playable at all, and often by a wide margin. So, well, on an individual card basis, we're pretty good at catching that stuff. Initiative as a mechanic-wide thing, just kind of has a blind spot for us, and I think we've gotten a lot better about catching that. And my hope is, fingers crossed, you won't see that happen again in internal formats, at least anytime soon. So anyway, that's my vibe. Sorry about White Plume Adventure and Initiative. And, I think the good news, maybe, I don't know, is maybe it's not good. I'm curious on your perspective, actually, Michael. But I feel like post-ban and post-people understanding how it works in internal formats, we've gotten to a point where Initiative can show up a little bit. It is a deck among many options. And what it does is kind of cool. It's an aggressive strategy. It has some draws that are annoying. But now it kind of just falls into, hey, it exists in internal formats. It is a deck that is out there. It is a new archetype. As opposed to, like, busting the best thing to do. And when that happens in an internal format, that can kind of be nice. But certainly not something that I think we want to aim for very often. So I don't know what your perspective is on the whole thing. But anyway, TLDR, thumbs down. Hope it doesn't happen again.
So a few months ago, I still thought the deck was, like, super busted. I was playing it. It won me a bunch of money. Qualified me for one of the RCs on Modo. So that was cool. And I loved that. I think currently, as it is, it's fine. Because, like you said, the deck's not, like, crushing everything. And it's definitely something people can adapt to. I will say, it's not my favorite thing to exist just because of the amount of complexity it adds.
Yeah. The mental overhead is so huge, right?
Yeah. And I've seen people say the same thing about it in Cube, where it's like, you know, Cube is like this format where people who haven't played in 5 years can just be like, oh yeah, I loved cubing. And they'll sit down and they'll play this card and they're like, wait, what does this do? And then, like, you show them the dungeon and they're like, what is happening? I don't.
Right, you know, it's a bad sign. It's like, oh, I'll explain it to you. Pulls out dungeon card. This is not helpful. how does this work? Right. Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, a real canary in the coal mine. Or I don't know, what's the opposite of the canary in a coal mine? The after, I don't know. I don't have a good metaphor. But anyway, the real thing is, I think it's extremely telling that people don't want to do it, right? It's like, people are like, I'll do it because it's powerful. Like, this is a powerful magic card, or a powerful ability. I'm going to play it because it wins games or whatever. But people on the whole are like, I just do not want to engage with this. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to learn what this does. I don't want to have to bring it with me to a tournament. I don't want to draft it in cube. I'll put it in my deck because it's strong, and I know it's strong. But, like, I don't want to put this in my cube deck. It's like a whole thing I got to manage. And to me, that's very telling. I think if you compare to Monarch, right, Monarch is also busted in one-on-one play. It's not designed for one-on-one play. It's bananas in cube, like, all this stuff. But in cube, you're like, ooh, yeah, cool. I'll build my little, like, you know, protect the queen deck where I grab the Monarch early, and then, you know, maybe my opponent doesn't attack me, or I'm an aggro deck and I get fourth rowing us. I always say that wrong. I like, you know, get the Monarch early and it's really cool or whatever. There's at least some appeal to that. I feel like that's something people are much more willing to engage with. Where Initiative always feels like they're playing it against their will, which is never never a great spot, right?
Yeah. I will also say,
agree or disagree.
Yeah, I was enjoying playing it, so I don't want to disagree, but I kind of want to disagree, but also I do agree. Most people are not happy when it comes out. And it's been a very similar experience with stickers. People are not happy with those. But, like, I was going to say, like, I played the deck in paper for the first time after playing it for, like, a month online, too. That was a much worse experience, too, that I, like, wasn't ready for. Online, you know, Moto just kind of handled everything. Like, clicked my room in the dungeon. You had the pretty picture. And, like, playing it in paper and being like, well, here's my dungeon, and here's yours, and here's the initiative token, and this is how we're going to keep track moving through. I was like, this is a lot. And yeah, most of my opponents weren't happy to do it. And yeah, not the best.
It's a whole thing. Anyway, so that's my answer. Long answer to your question, but there you go.
Okay. So he also wanted to ask, what are your thoughts on Ancient Tomb becoming, like, a pillar of Legacy, and how do you view the whole grief scam thing in Modern and Legacy? More things that people don't love.
I think Ancient Tomb becoming a pillar of the format was just an inevitability. Like, one of the strongest things to do in all of Magic is fast mana, and the more cards that get printed, the better fast mana is. So, you know, having to balance around, having 3 mana on turn 2 is something that Legacy just has to be able to withstand. I don't think Ancient Tomb is going anywhere necessarily. I mean, I don't make the call, but I'd be surprised if it was. I just feel like it's just a as the format gets more and more reduced to its bare roots, extra mana equals power. And that's kind of the deal with Ancient Tomb. In terms of, there's a second part of the question. What was it?
Grief Scam in both Modern and Legacy.
It's kind of cool that it created a brand new... let me finish, everyone listening out there. it's kind of cool that it created a brand new archetype. Like, that's kind of neat that there's this new style of play that never existed before. So I'll say that as, like, the historical deck builder. Like, I think that's kind of cool. The double Thoughtseize you right away. Keep my creature. Not the most fun thing in Magic. I don't really know what to say beyond that. It's like, yep, it's not very fun to play against when it gets a good draw. It can be inconsistent. I'll say some games are very funny because I feel like whenever you play against that kind of deck, it's like they spend all their resources and the end result is you have no action in your hand and they have like a small menace creature. And it's like, okay, well, I hope I draw some action. And if you draw a way to kill off their grief, then you're just like in this slap battle where you're like, well, I don't know, I'll play my Orcish Bowmaster and I get a token. I'll attack you for two. And then it's like, all right, well, I'll suspend the Crashing Footfalls and four turns from now I'll get a 4/4 or whatever, right? So there's some goofy interplay like that that happens. Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool that it's a new novel deck. I think it's not the most fun thing out there. And could see more action being taken against in the future. Not my call, not my job to ban cards in Modern, but that's kind of where I am on it.
So your answer to that question kind of got me curious. There's the whole philosophy of like big games versus small games. Like the small games, you know, both players are kind of lower on resources and trying to work it out with what they have. And big games, you know, more like the Ancient Tomb. Things I like doing, like Primeval Titan, where you like kind of going large and just the board gets filled of like lots of permanents and everybody's working with a lot of resources. Just out of curiosity, as a player, like, are you more on the big game or a small game side?
I love grinding out, eking out an advantage. Like a good limited. I love limited. Limited is one of my favorite formats, and I love it when a game goes long. You get to like make those tiny micro decisions about attacking and blocking that matter. So I think I'm much more on the small game category. I do think that part of why I love Cube, which is one of my favorite things to do in all of Magic, is you kind of get the best of both worlds, right? Because you're playing limited, you have a lot of games that are small games where you expend your resources and have to chip in with some damage. But you also get some big games, right? And often they're big games that become small games. And so that's probably why I like Cube so much.
Do you think we've seen the peak of complexity creep in standard sets?
It's hard for me to answer that question because there's a lot of different ways of being complex. You know, I think a lot of people point to like Lost Caverns of Ixalan having, I think, the most words. It's the wordiest set ever or something like that. There was some data about this. And words are one way of measuring complexity, but there's a lot of other things that are very complex, right? We run an internal teaching league here at Wizards for new people that come in who want to learn Magic. And as the person who leads that league and has taught, or I guess formerly left the league, he's not with the company anymore, but as he left, but who has taught tons of people, always said, one of the most complicated things to learn all of Magic are just three words, counter-target spell, right? A lot of people just don't understand what that even means. It takes a lot of time to explain to somebody, and it's very simple. It's three words, but it's hard to wrap your head around. So there's a lot of different kinds of complexity. There's board complexity. You look at Lorwyn block. That block is, read every individual card, and it's like pretty straightforward. But then you draft it, and the games are mind-melting because someone has a Silver Guild Dowser, and your attacking is impossible, and it's a mess. So it's really hard for me to answer that question, because it depends on what you're pointing at and what kinds of complexity. Is it interaction complexity? Is it words? All that kind of stuff. What I will say is I feel like there's a couple things we've gone overboard on in the past couple of years that we need to reel ourselves back on a little bit. And two of the big ones are double-sided cards, because double-sided cards, just you have to learn two cards for everyone. And a double-sided card should have like one card between the two sides, not two cards between the two sides, or three cards between the two sides, you know? So I think we need to reel ourselves back on that a little bit. And then it's external game components, right? Initiative being a great example. It's just a lot of extra complexity you have to learn on things that exist not necessarily in the game. So Day-Night is a good example of this, where it's the thing that you have to track forever. It's not that enjoyable, and it adds complexity to every game. So I think, you know, there's some stuff we're going to have to reel back in. There's a lot of different ways to be complex. So it's a hard question for me to answer, like, yes or no on. But there's a lot of things that we're thinking about and actively considering there. So hopefully that helps.
And that question was from Michael. Next question is from friend Ryan Freeberger. Big part of the Legacy Pick crew. Shout out to them. But so he would like to hear your thoughts about Universes Beyond cards and how they've been impacting Eternal formats, whether the rate has been about what you expected, if there's been any surprises. We're going to leave off the second part of his question because I know you definitely can't speak to it. But I don't know if you can give us anything about the Universes Beyond stuff.
Yeah, just, you know, the Universes Beyond cards are legal in Eternal formats, legal in Legacy, legal in Vintage from Commander decks and stuff. You know, one of the things that happens when you make a ton of new Magic cards, and they're all with weird, wacky abilities, so they often aren't in Commander sets, is some of them inevitably are going to get used in ways you don't expect in Eternal formats. And we don't aim for that. We're not trying for that. But it certainly can happen. So, you know, Triumph of St. Catherine showing up a bunch or whatever. So we're definitely aware of it. It probably will, you know, frankly, it probably will happen in the future because we're going to keep making Universes Beyond cards. But I think we just need to be vigilant about it and, you know what kind of cards to keep an eye out for. But just like any Magic product, you make, you know, sometimes there's a true name nemesis that shows up. And hey, that's not a Commander deck too. And that showed up in Legacy for a while. Probably will happen at some point, but we're not actively trying to make it happen. And we're actively trying to make sure it doesn't happen. So hopefully it doesn't happen too often. I did see someone like untap their Time Vault with Sonic Screwdriver, which I was really not expecting.
I don't know that card. Is it? Can you share with the class what Sonic Screwdriver is?
It's a 3-mana mana rock with 3 different activated abilities, but one of the abilities is untap an artifact. So you can do Voltaic Key. And I was like, well, I didn't expect that card to show up, but I guess it's powering out Time Vaults. Okay, here we go.
Look, the Screwdriver shows up in like every episode of Doctor Who, so it makes sense that it would show up.
Yeah, there's some reason a vintage deck was playing it. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I was like, oh, well, that didn't have that on my bingo card.
Okay, so the next comment is from Joseph Dyer, and he just wants to remind you that you're awesome.
Oh, Joseph, you're awesome. So thank you.
He is awesome. You're both awesome. I agree with both parties. So Eternal Casual wants to thank you for the Retro Frame reprints, and then I know elsewhere, like, Billy was asking, like, do you think those are still being well received? Can we expect more, or are we getting fatigue of them?
So huge fan of the Retro Frame. I want to try and get people the staples they need in the Retro Frame. But like anything we do, I think we also have to be careful to not just do it all the time on every single card. You know, I feel like we did Retro a lot. Like, you hadn't seen it in a very long time, and then we did it for Time Spiral Remastered, which was like, ooh, cool, it's back. And then we did it for Brothers War, and then the Floodgate, and maybe we did it for Modern Horizons in between there or something. But anyway, I feel like the Floodgates kind of opened, as everyone's like, oh, Retro, cool, we'll put that in. It's the hot thing. I think we might have overdone it a tad. We should pull back on that a little bit. I still want to make sure that staples get Retro Frames, so your Legacy decks can have Retro versions. I think they're still really cool. We should do them. But we should just make sure to use it judiciously and not just do it. They do it intentionally and not just like, oh, we need a cool thing for this set. No, we'll put this in the Retro Frame. Why not? I overall feel good about where it landed. And I'm stoked people are using them, right? I love that people have the opportunity to get those cards in the Retro Frame. It makes me really happy. So you can expect to see more in the future for sure.
Good. I will say I am like desperate for Elvish Reclaimer.
Elvish Reclaimer. Okay. I'll see what I can do.
That's all I want. You know, that would be the perfect gift for me.
All right. That's up here now. So we're good.
So I know you have to get going, so I definitely don't want to make you late for anything, but thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast. Anything you want to throw out before we let you go?
No, look, I'll just say thank you for having me on. It's really great to have this opportunity to talk with the Legacy and Eternal community, and thank you all for being some of the most like passionate fans in all of Magic. Like, whenever I talk to a Legacy or a Vintage player, people are just like stoked. They're like, I've been playing this game for so long, I love it. Or sometimes they're like, I started playing last year and Legacy's the best, right? I'm like, cool, awesome, wasn't expecting that, you know, but that's great. So it really is for all kinds of folks and people, and I just really commend everyone out there that helps bring people into this format, because it is so great and it is so cool. Let's make sure people are playing it. So thank you very much for all that, and thanks for all your hard work on making the show happen.
Yeah, of course. I guess we'll wrap up there. Hopefully I get to see you in Chicago. I do have a feeling I'll probably be playing in your event, so.
Well, I will see you there.
Yeah. And to the listeners, not going to do the usual wrap up. Don't want to waste Gavin's time, but thanks so much for listening, and Billy will be back next week. Thanks again, Gavin, and to the listeners, we'll see you all next week.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Devin Maya taps with green, the CNC's reclaimer. Untap sack of flags, don't go seek the planes. Then tutor up the stage, so pull out your playbill. Darkness podcast starring Billy Mitchell and Michael Mapson on the microphone. Dripping in Mox Diamonds, the collector of curtains up on act one of this magic show. Set in a forest so dense it looks decomposed, with red look every night's clash against death shadow. On the legendary lake covered in ice and snow, underneath the surface looks a lonely evil, an avatar so dark it could cause upheaval. The night lunges forward, going for the kill, but death shadow's too tricky, it just won't sit still. Its stubborn denials compile a stack so thick, the bazooka bug emerges with Gurmag's angling. The night takes a swing at the zombie fishes, but falls submerged for such a distance. Forsaken in the haze of the street rave's fringes, who wanna stuff her out, they don't sneak forgiveness. Her final breath draws a deafening silence, a sound so sinister no one could describe it. It's like the subtle cracking of a turtle shell, or the surgical extraction of emerging hell. The shards of ice feel a force of vigor, the looming fear releases growing bigger and bigger, until a demon's fingers linger toward the shadow of death. An all-consuming hush, the land goes swept. The night washes up, frozen on the ice. Dryad arbors thaw her out in the green sun's light. An expedition map suddenly unfurls, revealing Merit Lage has rearranged the world.